Thank you. First of all, thank you to the chair and to the organizers. It's really a pleasure to be here. I improvised this presentation yesterday when I discovered that there would be a screen and there would be my face 4 meters high. I could not take that, so I had to improvise something, and it may be useful, but I was terrified at the idea of having my face there. So the little Greek boy who became a powerful pasha. This is a panel that is devoted to history, stories, and of course to things Greek. So things Greek are there, the little Greek boy. The story also, when you say the little Greek boy who became a powerful pasha, it sounds like a story. In fact, it sounds even like a tale. And for history, well, you have me. I'm the historian. So that's how the three requirements are fulfilled. Now, it's evidently a story, and this is what I'm going to dwell on. I'm not really concerned about the identity, the truthfulness or not, of this Etem Pasha's original identity. The real point, if I had, I would be in the identity and whatever panel. This is about the story, and it's about the overlap or the discrepancies between history and story. So this is a story, if you put it this way, and as a historian, you would have to be critical about this story. And you would have, first of all, to question the fact that maybe Etem Pasha was not so powerful, which is true, he was not. So you would take the powerful away. And second, I have to say from the very start that there is absolutely no hard evidence that he was Greek. So we lose the Greek. So what we have is a little boy who became a pasha, which is in itself a story because although it is true that every pasha has been at some point a little boy, the reverse is not necessarily true. And the reverse still sounds very much like a success story, a tale, and an oriental tale at that. So my whole concern here is to try to see to what extent this story overlaps with historical facts, and especially how the protagonists of this story, starting with the Pasha himself, viewed this story, used this story, and tried to make it meet the requirements of a certain historical truth. So if we take this to be a story, and if we accept that there is no historical truth to it, we're no longer bound by the rigor of demonstration as to sources, and we can use very flexible, say, sources. We do have sources. We have somebody who was there at the moment of the events of 1822, because it's in 1822 that the little boy is supposed to have been orphaned. And obviously, there was a reporter, Gégène, what's his name? Eugène Delacroix was there to report on the massacres of Chios. So all we have to do is decide whether this might be the little boy, the future Etem Pasha, or if, on the contrary, it's on the left side that we find him. This is the flexibility of a story, and obviously, if everybody in the 19th century, everybody meaning everybody on the Turkish side and everybody on the Greek side, and especially everybody on the European side, agreed on the veracity of this story, there must be some truth to it. I mean, there is no fire without smoke, or there's no smoke without fire, rather. So there must be some kind of a fire behind this smoke. So let's try to move on with this story. So what I propose is to look for textual evidence, and there again we have somebody else. This time it's not Gégène, it's Totor. It's Victor Hugo who reports on the events. And you may notice, and this is of course something where I would fall in disagreement with Professor Arvelaire, because he says, and he quotes, "Ami dit l'enfant grec, dit l'enfant aux yeux bleus, je veux de la poudre et des balles. I want powder and bullets." The problem is that, first of all, I never understood why the little boy from Chios would have blue eyes. I don't think that's very logical, but that's another question. But the real question is that in Etem Pasha's case, he's not a Greek hero. He's not a philosopher. He's not a democrat. He has nothing to do with the idealized type of the Greek. In fact, he doesn't even fulfill the role that Hugo wants to assign him. And therefore, instead of asking asking for powder and bullets, he becomes a captive. And from a captive, he becomes a slave. And from a slave, he becomes a convert. And from a convert, he becomes one of the first, in fact, one of the four first students, Muslim students, that are sent to France, to Paris, in 1831. This is what makes him extremely interesting. I'm still within the logic of a story, because this identity, this story, as it is built, stands really at the crossroads of what we imagine to be modernity at the time of these events. On the one hand, you have the War of Independence, the Greek War of Independence. You have one of the very modern romantic trends of the time, which is Philhellenism, illustrated by Delacroix and by Hugo. And of course, you have as a parallel discourse, you have the modernity and the modernization, the westernization of the Ottoman Empire, because what is strange, what is funny, what is ironic, in a sense, is that this little boy who is supposedly taken away from the roots of his island, from his maternal land, will be used as an instrument of modernization by the Ottoman Empire itself. His master, his owner, he is a slave, will send him to Paris to get educated, and he will come back an engineer from Paris after he finishes the École des Mines, the mining school, the prestigious, one of the prestigious grandes écoles of Paris. So it is a very strange story indeed, and this is what makes it extremely interesting, in the sense that he is not only a product of the Greek War of Independence, and not exactly in the way that Greek historiography would have it, but on top of that, he is already an instrument of the modernization of the Ottoman Empire. But at the same time, what makes him an aberration is that he is extremely anachronistic in his identity. He is a little bit of a Janissary, if you want, that is something that would have been logical in the 16th, 17th, even 17th century, but that had disappeared ever since the Ottoman conquests had stopped and the Ottomans had started recruiting from their own Muslim population and had abandoned what used to be their meritocratic system. So in that sense, in the 19th century, the events, the extraordinary events of Chios, provide the Ottomans with one last chance to try and revive the system that they had used so widely in the 14th, 15th, and 16th century, and try to produce this ideal type of a bureaucrat or of a military officer from individuals that are uprooted and created from scratch. I have to say that this, from the perspective, again, of his history and his story, is interesting because he, in a sense, vanishes from what is his original story, and he is adopted into another story, into another context. Slavery is obviously not a nice thing to think about, but it is the ultimate form of adoption. It is a transfer of identity from a transitional non-identity into a new identity. It is a form of rebirth. And Etem Pasha, the future Etem Pasha, is a very interesting case of this situation. And he becomes, very naturally, you might say, he makes smoothly this transition into the Ottoman system and becomes a pasha. You see him here with three of his sons. He had four sons, four surviving sons. There's one son missing, and that son is interesting especially from the perspective of this story, because that son is no other than the famous Osman Hamdi Bey, who is the founding father of archaeology in the Ottoman Empire. Poetic justice, fate, a return in a sense of his genetic predestination to do things Greek. We can imagine all sorts of things, and we can even imagine that he toyed with the idea that there was some kind of a poetic justice in the fact that he became the proprietor, in a sense, of antiquities, of Greco-Roman, but especially Greek antiquities, in the Ottoman Empire. But that's the story. If you look at the history, the reason for which he was and he became the chief of antiquities and the director of the Museum of Antiquities in Istanbul was basically because he was educated in Paris. And he was educated as supposedly a lawyer, ended up being a painter, and therefore had what it took to do that cultural thing that was expected from him in this case. And if he did go to Paris, it's basically because his father went to Paris too in the 1830s, and that therefore he had initiated this modernist approach to education through the West. And if he went to Paris, it was basically because he was enslaved. It was because he was the produce of this strange coincidence of circumstances in the 1820s that transformed him into an experimental guinea pig, you might say, of Ottoman modernity. So, historically speaking, there's nothing genetic about this. There's nothing that relates to the fact that he is Greek. In fact, he ends up being a defensor of Greek culture in the Ottoman Empire, mostly because he was the produce of a father who was himself enslaved and transformed into a modern man through education in the West. Now, what is interesting about this story or these stories is that for one single historical figure, I have three different stories. Three different stories, three different interpretations, three different perceptions of the same fate by the father, one son, and the other son. The father, Etem, himself, is extremely quiet about his origins. I've tried to track any kind of indication in his writings, in anything that would give us a clue as to the acceptance of his former identity. There is nothing. In fact, there are little white lies that suggest that he may have tried to hide his identity without ever lying. So his is a non-story. He tries, in a sense, to define himself as a tabula rasa, even if it is extremely naive, because everybody knows he is the little Greek boy from Chios. The second story is his son's, Osman Hamdi's story, who, born in 1842, is very happy with the story of the Greek boy and even brags about it. He's satisfied and he's comfortable with the story of his father being Greek, and therefore he's known to have flaunted this identity or his father's identity in public. And finally, there's the last child of the family, Halil, who is born in 1860. You have really 20 years apart for each individual. Etem around 1820, Osman Hamdi around 1840, and Halil in 1860. And he has the no story in the sense that he denies, refuses, and tries to completely modify the story of his father's origins by trying to invent a possible alternative that relates him to Circassia, the Caucasus, or the Black Sea region. Why? Well, simply because he is the product of a new modernity, one which, through education in the West, but in the Germanic system, makes him come closer to a nationalist feeling that is not comfortable with the idea of an identity that hangs in thin air and does not have a legitimate grounding in the national definition that is starting to prop up in the end of the 19th century. So, in a sense, and this is, I think, what is interesting about this story, the story is interesting because it relativizes completely the way in which we look at story and history. In a sense, historically, we cannot prove this story. But it is only through the story, through hearsay, and through what I call the smoke effect, that we end up getting a historical truth through non-historical facts, through a narrative, through narratives. That's one interesting point, and I think it is a sobering experience for historians to realize that there's more to find in a story than in the historical facts. And the other very, I think, amusing thing is that if Etem, the father, refuses to openly acknowledge his identity as a Greek boy, it is because he was educated in France in the 1830s. And if his son accepts this identity and even is happy with it, it is because he was educated in Europe in the 1860s. And if the last son, Halil, ends up refusing, denying, and trying to negate and replace that that question of origins, it is because he was educated in Europe and ended up espousing a nationalist perception of himself and of his father that could no longer tolerate the idea of these strange origins. Thank you.